Welcome to another episode of the Oncology On The Go podcast. I'm your host, Roman Fabricatore.
In an interview with Cancer Network, William Kennedy, a neuroradiation oncologist at the Ivy Brain Tumor Center, provided expert insights into the current state of radiosurgery for central nervous system tumors, highlighting a diverse array of available radiosurgery platforms. He explains that institutions like the Ivy Brain Tumor Center frequently use non-invasive surgical techniques with complex monitoring systems. Kennedy further underscored the critical importance of having a nuanced understanding of each technology's capabilities and limitations, as well as those of the practicing oncologist. Emphasizing a high patient volume and a wide variety of cases at his own practice, he suggested that the expertise of the staff at the Ivy Brain Tumor Center positions them at the forefront of radiosurgery development. Despite the benefits that technology provide for research advancement and treatment, Kennedy posited that the multidisciplinary team is essential in ensuring the successful delivery of novel radiosurgery techniques. This integrated approach ensures that each patient benefits from an individualized plan that leverages the full potential of modern radiosurgery.
So just to start off, what are some of the current non-invasive radiosurgery methods you're utilizing for central nervous system tumors?
Here we have three different ways to deliver radiosurgery, which, just to take a step back, there's no incisions. It's not an actual surgical procedure. Really, in concept, it's giving a very high dose of radiation to a small target in a very focused manner, usually over 1 to 5 days. And there's several different ways to deliver radiosurgery that are well established. We currently have three that we use at our institution on a regular basis. They're called a gamma knife, a cyber knife, and then another machine called a Varian True Beam with some kind of monitoring system called XactTrack. So it's a lot of shop talk, basically, but three separate tools to deliver these kinds of treatments. And there's a little bit of redundancy amongst all three of those different machines overall, but each has some slightly different advantages. And so I think about one is not necessarily better than the other, but rather for whatever situation or what problem that we're trying to solve with the patient, I just try and pick the right tool for that job.
Going off of that answer a little bit, how does the Ivy Brain Tumor Center position itself to be at the forefront of the cutting edge radiosurgery treatment?
You know, I would say, besides just having access to kind of the latest technology, of course, things like Gamma Knife and Cyber Knife, they have been in clinical use for decades now, but we've continually been updated, refined, and all that. So we're really dealing with the latest and greatest technology available to deliver radiosurgery treatments. But that's only one piece of the puzzle. What's most important really is not the tool itself, but who's using it. And so fortunately, at a place like Ivy Brain Tumor Center, where me and my radiation oncology colleagues, Dr. Barani and Dr. Diaz, support, you know, one of the biggest neurosurgery practices in the world. And so really just having the large amount of patients that we have to care for every day that come through our office, with a very wide variety of complex cases. Over time, over many years, that in and of itself builds an expertise and kind of a position to be at the forefront of figuring out what are kind of the limits that we can push these technologies to try and help patients. And so we're at a place where we have a high patient volume, a lot of complex cases as well. And then most importantly, it's not just the physicians, it's not just us radiation oncologists and our neurosurgery colleagues, but also, you know, a very well trained and expert support staff, because, you know, there's 24 people in my office that make these kind of things happen. All the physicists, the other planning specialists, the nursing therapist, even up to the front office. I mean, all that is some critical steps in that radiosurgery process. So having a team that's fully dedicated to that at all times helps position us well too.
Are you able to highlight any key clinical trials that are investigating radiosensitizing drugs?
Yeah, I think in the brain tumor space, because I specialize not only in caring for patients with various brain tumors, but also head and neck cancers, where we also use radiosensitizers and are investigating some others. In the brain tumor space, really, on a national level, you know, there's some different concepts that are going through some of the larger trial organizations that I'm a part of, but currently, most of those have been either recently concluded or there's new concepts kind of in development. But right now, there are a couple here at Ivy, one of which is either in the newly diagnosed or in the recurrent setting in patients with glioblastoma, testing a medication called AZD1390. And so that's kind of an investigational medication. That the whole mechanism of how we think it works is by sensitizing tumor cells to radiation therapy by blocking an enzyme or a molecule in tumor cells called ATM. That's a really important component of repairing radiation-induced damage in tumor cells. And so we've been actively treating patients with that. With that ATM inhibitor, AZD1390, I'm here at Ivy in combination with radiation therapy after a surgery. And so that trial is currently under investigation, and we hope to have results on not only safety, but effectiveness over the next several months or a couple years or so. These trials do take time over many patients to really know if this is the right next approach. One of the other medications that we're using that's kind of considered a radiation sensitizer is called niraparib. So that medication is a medication that inhibits a molecule called PARP. And so another really important DNA repair kind of machinery in tumor cells. And we think that it works synergistically with radiation therapy. And so actually, you know, we were a little further along with that concept now, whereas we had some encouraging initial results in a smaller group of patients and show that those patients, again, smaller cohort, not randomized head-to-head comparison, but showing that we had some encouraging initial results and such that we're able to open up a much larger randomized clinical trial where we're basically giving half of patients standard of care radiation with the standard of care chemotherapy called TMZ, and the other half of patients getting radiation therapy with this radiation sensitizer, niraparib. And that's really the trial is expected to last multiple years, evaluating this in several hundred patients across the world. And so that's actually been from other radiation sensitizer research from IV. So those are the two big concepts that we're testing radiation sensitizers in. And so we're very excited about those.
No, they sound very interesting, and I'm excited to see the results of them when they come out. So, in your previous answer, you did kind of touch upon the multidisciplinary team aspect, but as a radiation oncologist, how do you work with your other multidisciplinary providers to help create that best possible care for your patient?
It's not just the weekly tumor boards and things like that, where they sound really official, but that's really just our structured weekly team huddle regarding patient care. And a lot of it's just having those conversations and kind of a formal, structured kind of environment. But that's really just one component of it. Of course, the physicians, not only us radiation oncologists, neurosurgeons, the neuro-oncologists, the radiologists who read the scans, the pathologists look at the tumor, make the diagnosis under the microscope. That's only one part of the whole team here, one part of that multidisciplinary care. The fact of the matter is that many more conversations are had and back and forth and all that on a daily basis between all of us team members to figure out the best plans for patients, not just this formal 1 hour once a week meeting. And also all of the other really important components of the team, whether it's dietitians, physical therapists, occupational therapists, speech language pathologists. There's a whole host of even non-physician experts to help provide these really important parts of multidisciplinary care too. And we're fortunate to have the full roster of all those important, even non-physician providers to care best for these patients, because they often are dealing with a whole lot, and there's a lot of really important aspects to the care that need to be addressed. Basically meeting at least once a week and having those conversations with all of those experts on a daily basis is the way that we do it. It just boils down to communication and availability and showing up.
Simplified. I love that. As a radiation oncologist, what do you predict is on the horizon for the head and neck cancer space?
I think probably the biggest thing that we've really been, quite frankly, trying for many years now, has to do with de-intensifying treatment for patients with HPV-mediated head and neck cancers. And that's not a novel answer. Just to get a bit of background, for many years, for decades, when smoking rates were quite high, and it was for many years, the overwhelming majority of all head and neck cancer cases were primarily caused by smoking or heavy drinking, not as much from HPV or human papillomavirus. We've known over the past at least couple of decades or so that that pendulum has swung, where even though a cancer looks the same under the microscope, it's still considered a squamous cell carcinoma. It occurs in the same location as smoking-mediated cancers, such as the back of the tongue or the tonsil. We know that about two-thirds of these cancers are now caused by HPV, where their often prognosis is much better, cure rates are much higher, but we're still applying the same treatments that we used for a biologically different disease in the same location and that we have for decades in these patients. And so basically trying to safely de-intensify treatment to hopefully decrease some of the acute and late side effects that radiation and chemo can cause, because head and neck chemo and radiation is one of the toughest, most difficult treatments in all of oncology for patients to get through, even with a very closely knit kind of expert team that we have at our disposal here. But it's also figuring out how do we do that? How do we de-intensify treatment again while maintaining excellent cure rates? And over multiple very large randomized trials across the US in hundreds and hundreds of patients, we haven't really been able to find the right combination yet, whether it's decreasing the dose of radiation or switching out the classic radiosensitizing chemotherapy used called cisplatin, trying other medications like immunotherapies or other non-cisplatin medications like cetuximab or even some other newer small molecule inhibitors. There still hasn't been a winner so far. And so, but that is really the main direction that, and probably the biggest unmet need and kind of where kind of most efforts are going to in the field of head and neck oncology. Of course, there are many other topics too, but that's really the biggest one. And that's most of where most research focus has been and quite frankly should be right now.
And then looking at back at the conversation we've had today, what do you hope your colleagues take away from it?
I think, from a kind of a 10,000 foot view, I would say here, without getting into the nitty-gritty of radiation sensitizers and de-escalation for HPV cancer, really, despite all the great technologies that we have here at Ivy, what I think really makes this place great and what makes me proud to work here and what I think means the most for our patients is how closely all of us providers communicate with each other, how closely knit of a team we are. And I would say that just being available, showing up to tumor board, always picking up the phone when your colleague calls, discuss a tough case, never be afraid to ask for help. All those things I've learned since I've been in practice here, and I think those are really what make the difference more than anything. I especially wish someone kind of gave me that advice when I was starting out.
Don't forget to subscribe to the Oncology on the Go podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or anywhere podcasts are available, or listen online at cancernetwork.com/resources/podcasts. The Oncology On The Go podcast is the official podcast of cancernetwork.com, the home of the journal Oncology. For more information, visit us at cancernetwork.com and find us on Twitter at Cancer Network without the O, or on Facebook and LinkedIn at Cancer Network.